so that you're ready to go. So the softwares that, that are there to install are basically this RMPL, which is, if you want, it's an interface between what you want to do at the higher level, because you have some equations, you put them in a particular form, you tell the code or you tell this compiler what particular techniques you want to use to implement things, and then this software will generate the full code on its own. You're gonna have to do very, very little, and then just press a button and the code will be there and finished, which is a good thing, because then in a very short time, we actually can get something that you can then get your hands on and then try to solve particular problems. We have this basic link first, where you should go, and you're gonna have links to all the different pages, the projects, et cetera. The other parts of the software that you're gonna be installing have to do with this visualization. I mean, it's incredibly important, once you have a problem that you have discretized, to be able to interact with the data. And by that, I mean, you want to make sure that the solution you're getting has the right behavior, behaves in the way you hope it is, but also, more importantly, to be able to test things. We're gonna discuss today different techniques to implement the equations. You think you're doing something, you should be able, at the end of the day, once you have the finished product, to test that what you've done is precisely what you set out to do. This thing is annoying. And we're gonna learn this software as we go along. So just make sure you install that. Then we have a course, a web page that I'm updating. So we're pointing to last year's still. But by and large, we're doing exactly the same thing. The only difference is that Scott Noble will not be teaching, being part of the teaching team this year. It's gonna be mainly myself and Franz Pretorius. And we're gonna be covering these topics. Just a few other things. There are people in the audience, so there are here two students that are doing, that work in numerical relativity. They hang around in the tutorials as well. So one is Miguel Silao, there is Federico Villagra. You can ask them questions as well. And we're gonna have three projects, three numerical projects. We're gonna ask you that you do at least one of them. You'll see later on what the projects are. They're starting from very simple and they're working their ways up. So at least one of them we'll be asking you to do, mainly to get familiar with how you go about solving a numerical problem, and once you have a solution, check that your answer is correct. One particular problem that relativity has is that the variables that we deal with, the equations we're gonna be iterating, once you see the solution, you cannot guess whether the solution is correct or not. As opposed to astrophysics, where people typically prepare the code, run a simulation for a single discretization length, and we'll discuss more about this as we go along. And then they say, this is my solution. If you want to steer fear in an astrophysics talk, you ask, how do you know the solution is correct? Have you ever checked conversions? And typically the answer is no. And the answer is no because it's once they see how things behave, or once they see the solution, they kind of have a good feeling of whether a solution is correct or not, because they're plotting things that are physical. They're plotting the density of the star. They're plotting the fluid velocity that a configuration of matter has at any given point. And you more or less have intuition on where something is behaving well or not. With gravity, we don't know. We don't know whether a metric behaving in a particular way, a metric variable behaving in a particular way, is something that is sensible until you do much more work. And so that's one of the things that we have to do, and so we want to be absolutely certain from as much rigor as we can that the solution we're obtaining is the correct one. I'm going to discuss how to do that. So we're going to have at least one of these projects and then some other homeworks that are more on the analytical front, and you can choose to do two of the numerical projects or one of the numerical projects and the analytical ones. So let me start with, as I said, the very basics thing. So all this is available to you, so I don't think it makes any sense for you to take notes of what I'm saying, but just write down the pieces or any particular thing that you may want to stress regarding the notes that we have. So I'm gonna be following mainly this week, these notes. Once we go to the second and third week, we're going to be departing a little bit from the notes we have, but by and large, this week we're going to be following them. So these are the topics we're going to be covering. So the first week is just making sure we have the fundamentals. First, we're going to just discuss the techniques to go on the numerical side before we actually begin to discuss general relativity in its own and how to go about incorporating things numerically. Because the reason I want to start with that is that I try to get you up to speed as soon as possible so that you can then begin to look at the projects themselves. And then we're going to get into gravity. The second week will be mainly dedicated to matter, fluid equations. And you'll see as we go along why is it we're going to discuss separately gravity and fluids. Typically, we're going to be interested in doing both. If you're thinking about, say, a neutron star that is about to collide with a black hole, and you want to obtain the gravitational wave signals that this system will produce because LIGO is about to measure precisely these kind of systems, you're going to have to be incorporating everything, fluid and gravity. But the equations that describe the fluid dynamics are significantly different from those of general relativity. They're both nonlinear equations, but as we go along, we're going to stress the differences. And because of the differences between one and the other one, we're going to have to use the very different techniques. And we'll say things as we go along. We're going to be climbing up this ladder from the bottom up. So what we want to discuss today and part of tomorrow is how to solve essentially partial differential equations using some numerical techniques. The particular technique we're going to discuss is finite differences. So first I'm going to have to defend why I'm going to work with finite differences. These are some very basic, references on the topics we're going to be talking about. Perhaps the most, the best one is this last one done by Kreis, Gustafsson, and Lolliger. All three people are essentially fathers of the field. They have pretty much defined everything we know and as in rigorous form, and that's an absolutely outstanding piece of reference. But it's very deep on the analytical and mathematics of the problem. Okay, so this is what we're going to say, or this is kind of the game we want to play. We're going to assume that we have some classical field equations, and again, I'm going to stress we're going to keep everything at the classical level for simplicity and for concreteness. We're going to be assuming that our system of equations is governed by partial differential equations that may be time dependent. By and large, we're going to be concentrated on cases that are time-dependent. That's because those that are time-independent are going to be, in a sense, a subcase of what we discussed. We're going to be distinguishing at the formal level the problems we're going to solve in two types. One is going to be called the initial value problem. Essentially, there is a problem where you assume there are no boundaries in your system. So if you imagine that you're dealing with an asymptotically flat space-time, boundaries are supposed to be infinitely far away to not influence anything. So for all intents and purposes, as long as you give the initial state of the system at some given time, the equations of motion tell you what the solution will be at a later time. So pictorially, what we're thinking in, say, in the asymptotically flat case, that if you give initial data on some initial hypersurface, you can obtain the full future evolution, the full spacetime above this, without any other piece of information. However, there are problems that are called initial boundary value problems. So here, in contrast, we can be thinking that we're trying to do something, say, in ADS. You know well by now that ADS has time-like boundaries, which are in total causal contact with the interior space-time. And so, given the information of the state of the system at some given time, it's not enough to predict what the solution is going to be at a later point, because the information at the boundary is going to be also crucial to determining the solution of the problem. However, even though that distinction we can make at the mathematical level, at the formal level, numerically, we're always going to be solving an initial boundary value problem. Just because at the computation level, you can never put an infinite grid. We're going to have to put an artificial boundary somewhere. And you're going to have to try to define these boundary conditions so that they mimic the fact that they shouldn't be there. So if you're putting boundary conditions that affect the physics in a strong manner inside, we're not doing the right work. So for that, we're going to be trying to do two things. One is to put approximate boundary conditions. They approximate the fact that they shouldn't be there. And once we have a solution, part of our work will be to try to convince anyone else that the solution we're obtaining does not depend on our choice of boundary conditions, either by changing boundary conditions or, more typically, by running the same problem or studying the same problems where the boundaries are now placed twice as far and noting or showing that the solution that, for a time of interest, hasn't changed when we vary these locations. So this is what we are going to be typically saying, given that generically we're always going to be working with an initial boundary value problem. Just to shorten it, we're going to be saying that we're going to be working with initial value problems, and it's going to be assumed that boundary conditions will have to come one way or another. We were going to be trying to specify the state of the system at some given initial time. Again, so if you're thinking of two black holes that are about to collide, you say, well, at some early time in their history, they're at some distance with some given initial configuration, and we want to know what happens as time goes by. We're going to assume, and as we go along, we're going to be more rigorous in trying to specify when this is going to be the case. We're going to be assuming that the solution exists. If not, we wouldn't be trying to solve the problem, of course. But more importantly, the solution is unique, and it's determined by the conditions we're imposing. So now, let's say, suppose we have such a problem, we have defined it, and we're, as we go along, we're going to be more rigorous as how we have or what pieces we have to give in order to define it in a consistent manner. But let's assume that somehow we're getting to that problem. Now we want to have the computer tell us a solution, because again, for most of the problems of interest, we're dealing with, say, nonlinear system of equations. We don't know the solution. We don't have a good feeling of what the final solution would be, and we require this work to actually obtain or dig out the important piece of the solution. And it's very important. There is no way that I can stress this too strongly. There are tons of problems in physics that the inability of being able to solve them with pencil and paper have left around many low-hanging fruits that are very, very important. They're now coming with a new attitude saying, regardless of the problem I'm trying to deal with, I can always work hard enough on the computation level to find the solution. And there are plenty of examples of people getting to be, quite famous for finding a solution of a problem that has been open for many years. And the only thing that they did, in between quotes, is just go with a different attitude and press as hard as needed on the computational front to actually obtain what the solution is. So we're going to start with some system of partial differential equations. Of course, computers are not good to solve those. We have to change the problem. We're going to be changing the problem into essentially an algebraic problem, and that computers are extremely good at solving. They're good at trying to find solutions to algebraic problems. We have to define what the algebraic problem will be. We're going to also assume the concept, or that for the case of interest, we're dealing with a well-posed problem. So let me define what a well-posed problem is. So well-posedness is a rigorous definition in mathematics. That basically requires, for any given problem, three requirements to be satisfied. The first is that whatever problem you're dealing with has to have a solution, so a solution exists. Second, that solution is unique. And third, and this is the most important one in a sense, and also the most delicate, that the solution depends continuously on the initial and boundary data. So what the heck does this mean? It means the following. Suppose we give some initial state of the system, and we obtain a solution. Number one and number two will say, we're obtaining that solution. Number two says that solution is a unique one. But now we want to know that if we have, let's say pictorially, this initial configuration, someone comes and changes initial data and just gives it a little blip there, arbitrarily small, and in, say, in energy, and it's just a small perturbation. So you expect the solution that you obtain after having changed ever so slightly your initial configuration should be pretty close to the solution you obtain when you don't have that piece. If that behavior is not satisfied, it's not says to depend continuously in this initial data. So pictorially, you imagine that you have a space of initial configurations. If you pick this particular configuration, which is, say, the one without the blip over there, you evolve for a while, and you obtain a solution here. Now you imagine that you just depart ever so slightly from it on the initial configuration space, and you just look what this final solution is going to be, and it could drift away. But this drift in here is controlled by the initial drift in a continuous manner. That is, if I bring this continuously onto that point, this solution will come to that solution. Of course, this is important on the computational domain, because you're never actually solving the problem you want to solve, the problem you write down. You're always solving an approximation, maybe to round off. And so if this is not satisfied, the solution we're obtaining at the end of the day, we are not sure is the solution of the problem we really wanted to do. And this seems kind of a rather obvious point, but if you look at many of the, actually very many of the theories of gravity that people are putting forward to try to resolve the cosmological problem, many of them can be shown to be complete garbage just because it's not satisfied. Let me give you a simple example of a problem that will have such a behavior. Suppose we're dealing with this kind of equation. So I'm going to imagine u, t equal u, x. That's going to be our workhorse for many problems. And we want to say what is the general solution of this problem. We can use Fourier transforms. So let me imagine that I write the solution u of t and x as some generic function of t times some Fourier mode e to the ikx. We can replace this in here. Okay, when we put this in here, it will just going to give us the time derivative of f times e to the ikx. And the right-hand side, f will come clean, and this one will give us just ik, right? So this problem will, this replacing in there gives us f, t equal f times ik. So now I can solve this problem, right? This is just going to be the solution to this will be f of t is e to the ikt. And the solution to this problem, at least in Fourier mode, for that particular given value of k, is given by right? So we haven't done anything profound here. So one particular thing we can say is, well, what is the norm of this solution versus time? And if we take the norm of this one, I'm going to have the norm of u. That's just equal to 1. And this is just easily realize that this is just an advection problem where the profile of this function will just change. It's just a translation at the speed of light, or a speed equal to 1, of the whatever initial profile we had. So that's one problem. Let me just show a different problem. Let me just write it here. Suppose I now change this to u, t. I'm going to put here some number. Well, not kappa, let me just use gamma, times u, xx. So I went from just first order in time, first order in space, as far as derivative, to first order in time, second order in space. So this one, and I do exactly the same thing. So I'm going to have f, comma t here. Here I'm going to have gamma. I have a second space derivative of e to the ikx. That's going to give me ik square of f. So I have something that is almost the same, but it's now f comma t equal gamma k square f. And the solution to this is f of t is equal to e to the gamma k square t. And so I can put everything together and say u of t is e to the minus gamma k square t times e to the ikx. IKX, yes. I can now do the same thing I did here and take the norm. So when I take the norm of the solution, this norm will go away because it's just one again, but I have u of t is equal to e to the minus gamma k square t. So if gamma is positive, we don't have a problem. This is going to be decaying. It's going to be a solution that decays exponentially with time. But if gamma is negative, we have something that is blowing up in time. Furthermore, remember this example we talked before, that if we have some initial configuration, we come and we add a little blip here. That little blip is a very short wavelength. That means it's a very high frequency. That means I'm now considering a k that is much, much larger than the initial one. And that means that that piece of the solution will be blowing extremely fast. So you can imagine now pictorially, and this again, we're going to be more rigorous as we go along, that we had some initial configuration that was very smooth. We come and give something that is very, very narrow, but it has very, very little energy. We wouldn't expect anything to be changed in a fundamental manner. But if we have an equation that looks like this with the wrong sign, that little piece will make the solution just depart widely away from the previous one that did not have that blip. In the context of this prospective, say, alternative theory's gravity, when people, the analog is writing an action, that means the equations of motion have a structure that says box, say, of the metric variable equals something, which here has three derivatives of the metric. That mismatch is analog to the mismatch that we saw here. Again, we're not going to this one. Well, we're going to be discussing the basics of how you know about this one. But it's sometimes just the very basics of understanding the underlying mathematical theory is enough to just rule out a whole set of families of options. So in physics, we think that any problem that can describe a physical scenario has to be well posed. And so just the requirement of well posedness is enough to rule out options. Yes? No, it doesn't have to be an equilibrium. It could be just very wildly behaving. But what you do expect that if the initial configuration is arbitrarily close, but not exactly the same as the R initial configuration that gave this widely behaving function, you would expect that R solution to have a qualitatively very similar behavior and quantitatively get closer and closer to the R solution if you reduce that. But here, I can always say I'm going to make the energy smaller and smaller, so I'm not adding anything to the system, but at the same time, I can make the wavelength shorter and shorter, and I keep going arbitrarily fast with respect to the R solution. And so then there is something wrong. As I said, it's in general, as it says here in the notes, it's not trivial at all to prove the system is well posed. But it is, in many instances, very, very easy to prove that the system is ill posed. Conditions like that, just observations like that, are very easy to say, okay, this cannot be a well-defined theory. Okay, so as I said, we're going to be, of everything we talk about, or we do in the course, we're going to be either discussing finer differences techniques, or it's very close cousin called the finite volume techniques. I'm going to explain this as we go along. But when you, in general, when you discuss how to implement numerically some PDE systems, there are many, many different options. There are, in addition to finite differences and finite volumes, which are the ones that we'll discuss, there are things called finite elements. This, for instance, is used routinely in engineering applications. Every time you design something, so for instance, the latest Boeing plane was designed, all the configuration using essentially finite elements techniques. And also spectral methods. These are much, much fancier methods. It gives you a lot better control of the system, but typically are not used when you're in quote-unquote discovery mode. They're used when you have a well understanding of the solution you are going to obtain, and they're extremely good methods to make the most efficient use of computational power and obtain a solution. But if you're trying to go after a problem for the first time, where you don't know what to expect, these methods are much more robust, are very natural, and very, very simple to understand. And so that's what we're going to be discussing. And in particular, all the problems that we're dealing with, by and large, are either very, very smooth or smooth, or the non-smoothness are simple enough that either finite difference or finite volumes will just do fine. And general relativity simulations or general relativity studies, by and large, are dominated by this, with a few exceptions where spectral methods are used. Okay, so just a few more words about what you gain by thinking the problem at least first in finite differences. It's extremely natural in many ways to just think in finite differences, because the only thing we're doing is just reinterpreting the basic steps that you did to understand calculus. You always assume that, okay, a derivative can always be obtained by the difference of the values of the functions divided by the spacing in between the two points that you're that you have at your disposal. They're incredibly flexible, and they're applicable in complete generality. And they do not require the equations to be written in any particular form. As we'll discuss next week, if we want to use these finite volume methods, you actually want to force or rewrite your system in a very special form to actually be able to exploit a particular technique. Finite differences will just do fine, regardless of how the equations are written. They're also very natural in trying to understand how the system behaves, how your final solution will behave with respect to the discretization that you have chosen. Mathematically, to try to obtain a rigorous analysis is quite difficult, but it's definitely possible. But actually, at a practical level, it's a lot easier to just do experiments and obtain all the information you need just by the experiments themselves. And with that information, you can tell a lot about the solution that you're obtaining. And this is something we'll discuss a little bit today, but a lot more tomorrow. And as we'll discuss in the third week of the course, they are extremely useful to for adaptivity. There are many, many problems of interest where you start with something that is very smooth, but nonlinearities develop shorter and shorter wavelength structure in your solution. And these techniques are very useful to actually keep adding points on the fly and just concentrate discretization where it's needed. And they are extremely clean to parallelize the problem. So typically, when you're doing these large problems, you require this, the use of parallel computers, and they are very, very easy to actually chop in different pieces, send to different cores, and obtain or actually be able to exploit these supercomputers to your advantage. So we're going to be discussing some very simple problems, as I said, first, as we work our ways up. So we're going to, our kind of fiducial problem of interest will be of two types, either the wave equation in the simplest possible form, or this advection equation that I described before. In fact, later on, we're going to show that that problem is nothing else than a collection of those problems. And so we're going to typically end up discussing properties here, because wave equations can always be described in terms of advection equations. So we're going to kind of work through this kind of toy problem. We're going to assume that that's a problem where we want to find a solution of. We know that because it's a second order problem, second order equation, we need two pieces of information to specify completely the initial state of the system to evolve forward. We're going to assume that, okay, at the some initial time, let's call it t equal to zero, we know the value of the field, and we know the time derivative of the field. And we're assuming that the problem we're really trying to solve is a problem that is doesn't have a boundary. So it's all the way from minus infinity to infinity. But as we discuss computationally, we're going to have to introduce boundary conditions and discuss what we do. This system is very easy to prove that it's well posed, and it's, in essence, we already just did that. If we reinterpret this in terms of Fourier modes, we're going to see that the solution will have the same bound. So we also want to know what type of equations we're dealing with, and this I'm sure you have all heard before. This equation is a hyperbolic equation, as opposed to the other two, which we'll discuss later on, being elliptic, parabolic, and actually there is a third one, which is the Schrödinger's equations. Usually you might have seen in the literature people discussing the Schrödinger's equations is a special case of one of the other ones. Actually, it's not. It's a completely separate category on its own. So we have four kind of general families, and for by and large, we're just going to be discussing hyperbolic equations because those are, in a sense, the toughest to actually deal with, and are the ones that govern, say, general relativity, Maxwell's equations, Young-Mills, and hydrodynamics. It's going to be very useful for us to define the concept of characteristics of a PDE system, and this we'll discuss as we go along. And in particular, for this case, are very, very simple. You know that the solution, the general solution of the wave equation, can be written in terms of a left mover moving piece and a right moving piece. And so we just write them as generic functions. So if we have a generic function of x plus t and a generic function of x minus t, we know that's the general solution to the problem. And we can interpret this x plus t and x minus t very simply as saying this is the piece that, given, say, the initial configuration of the system, tells us what piece of the solutions are moving to the left, and this is what piece of the solution are moving to the right. And we care about that for more than one thing, or more than one reason. One reason may be defining particular initial configurations of the system, but perhaps more importantly, we'll be interested in knowing what moves in and in what direction because of the boundary conditions that we're going to be trying to specify. Just to give you some very basic tools that will be or basic definitions that we're going to use at different points. So typical initial data. So we want to, when we're in this discovery phase, we're going to be interested in trying to probe the systems with different configurations. And so it's going to be convenient for us for reasons that we'll see as we do our homeworks, that one possible choice for initial configuration is something that is determined by some Gaussian, because this is a very smooth function. It allows us to put a pulse at any arbitrary place that we want with any arbitrary width and any arbitrary amplitude. So that's something that, as you'll see in the projects that we have, we're going to be dealing with those as well. Okay, so let me describe a little bit of how you discretize in finite differences. We're going to be, the first problem we need to deal is that a function, and for the moment I'm just going to be considering that we have a single function. So this function u, and let's say we keep it in one dimension for simplicity, contains essentially infinite amount of information. It depends on x, which is a continuous variable, and also t. So that in order to deal with a tractable problem, we need to now reduce the amount of information. And we're going to do that by saying we're going to discretize the function in terms of a finite number of informations that we're going to describe by the following points. So let me just use n and say j, which by definition will be the value that u has at discrete values of t, and let me just say n delta t, and also discrete values of x, so we imagine that we have discrete levels in time. For simplicity, they are equispaced in time. So we can just label time as going up with an index n times delta t. And similarly with space, imagine that we have a grid that is perfectly uniform, and spatial points are separated by delta x. Of course, we can change that later on. And if we are using adaptivity, we might end up choosing a subset of these points, or that a sub-region here where there are, we have many more points and the spacing is smaller. For the moment, we're going to keep it as simple as possible. We're going to have equi-spacing in space and also in time. So with that, what we're doing is we're replacing the continuous function u that depends on t and x by just a discrete value of u with labels n and j, one denoting time, the other one denoting space. So now we have changed that. We no longer have a continuous function. We want to now also have a discretization for the derivative operators that we may deal with. So this is, again, kind of pictorial what we have there. We have different points, more points to the left, more points to the right, and these are space points. It's going to be convenient also to assume, and this is going to be a fundamental reason behind this, to assume that there is a relationship between delta t and delta x, that they are tied. We'll see later on that stability will require that we don't define delta t arbitrarily large with respect to delta x. Actually, there's going to be a bound for delta t related to delta x that we'll require for stability. So for that reason, we're going to then simplify things and say, for instance, that the spacing between points is given by h, and delta t will be given by some number, lambda, which will be there at our disposal. We can change it. And this flexibility may also help us when we actually do implementations to try smaller time steps or larger time steps to try to obtain compare the solutions. And the spacing is going to be given by h. So at the end of the day, there is a single parameter that governs how fine our grid is, and it's just this h. So if we take h formally to 0, we should be able to recover the analytical continuum expressions for everything. So as I said, the next step is having discretized the values of the function, we want to discretize the derivative operators. And once we have that, we're essentially done as far as coming out with an algebraic problem for an initial continuous problem. So we're always going to be thinking, at least in the back of our mind, that this relation holds, that this discrete set of points are actually just a mere representation of a continuous function that we started with, and this is the one we're interested in. So we can always go back and forth, at least at the formal level, by writing, say, using Taylor approximations on the function u to then tie values, specific discrete values of u with respect to approximations. So we can always say that, for instance, the value of the function, say u at the point j, and we're not, because this is general, let me just drop this supra index n. We're going to say this is exactly equal to the value of the continuous function u evaluated at that particular point. You see why I do that in a second. And we can say the same thing with uj at the point j minus 1. We can relate it to the points in J by using a Taylor approximation. So we can say that u at J minus 1 is nothing but uj minus the spacing in between J and J minus 1 times the derivative of u with respect to x evaluated at the point J, and so on. So here, the only thing we're doing is just using a Taylor approximation based at the point x equal xj, say, for J minus 1 and also for J plus 1. And when we do that, of course, there are going to be minus signs or difference in sign in the odd derivatives and the same signs in the even derivatives. And now we can use this at an algebraic level to try to relate, say, the derivative of u, the analytical derivative of u with respect to x, to some combination of the values, the discrete values of u. So for instance, we can say, well, let's add up these three values on the left with arbitrary factors, let me call it C minus, C zero, and C plus, and we're already beginning to introduce some notation where we use minus and plus to denote the point to the left and the point to the right of whatever center point we might consider, which in this case is J. And we want to combine them such that the leading term in the right-hand side is the first derivative of the system. There might be other terms which were going to be what we call errors in our approximation. So if we ask for this to be satisfied, we derive three conditions, which are the following. So the addition of the three have to add up to zero, right? Because otherwise, let me just say, so we're multiplying this by C minus, this by C zero, and this by C plus. If we add the three, and the addition of these three numbers is not equal to zero, we're going to have a leading contribution proportional to uj, and that's not what we want. We want the leading contribution to just be the derivative. So those three conditions tell us this. And we can also require, I mean, this one, the zero knocks the leading term, the uj. The one gives us the first derivative. But because we have three equations, we could actually, or three numbers, we can ask for a third equation. And when we ask for this one, what we're also getting as an added bonus is that the leading order term beyond the leading order term will be higher order. So what we're doing is making zero the contribution of the second spatial derivative of u. So this is what we end up being able to get. These are the solutions, and then we notice that this, so the value of u at j plus 1 minus the value of u at j minus 1 divided by twice the spacing between the two is just u, the first derivative with respect to x of the continuous function, plus some error that goes to as h squared, but actually we know precisely what the function is. It's the third derivative here. So we know the error comes in the third derivative. So that very simple kind of exercise, now let us say that we can approximate the derivative with respect to x of the function u evaluated at x equal xj as u j plus 1 minus u j minus 1 divided by 2h. And of course, there was nothing special in here with respect to space, right? If I change this with time, I can say dt of u at level n is equal to u n plus 1 minus u n minus 1 divided by 2. And I'm going to put delta t here. And so, of course, this is at the point, say, j, 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 right? So this is at the same time level. Let me put n here. And this would be at the space level. So this is at the space level, and this is at the time level. So now we started with a continuous function and a continuous PDE, say, had we started with this equation for the unknown function u that depends on time and space. We can discretize this one by this collection of points, and we can discretize this equation by using these two options. With that, we can then replace back to our original equation and find an algebraic expression for, say, something that we don't know. And discuss this in in the next slide. So we find that the truncation error is of order of h squared. That is the difference between, and we'll discuss more about this, the difference between the analytical expected value and what we're going to end up doing is given by, or is governed by, h squared. So that's important. Knowing what is it that we expect as far as the error, how the error depends on the spacing, will lead us to having a tool or some observation to check where things are going the right way. We can always do an experiment and run or obtain solutions for different values of h, for h, and then plot them in a particular way and see that this is precisely the dependence. If we don't find that, then we actually might have made a mistake, and this is what the experiment is telling us. You can check, and this I leave as an exercise, that this particular combination also is a second-order approximation to the second spatial derivative that has the same truncation error, and that this let us re-express second spatial derivatives that are continuous in terms of discrete a discrete approximation. One particular thing that I should stress here is notice that when we look at an approximation to the derivative, we balance things. We were looking at the derivative of the point J, and I put a point to the left and a point to the right. And we're using equidistance grids. Whenever you do that, whenever the point of interest is at the center of your stencil, what we're actually doing is using a particular representation which is called centered. And we'll see later on why it is important. As long as you can do everything center, you're always going to gain an order h of error for free. But this we'll discuss more as we go along. So I leave us an exercise that show that that's the correct expression for a second order derivative. Of course, if we involve more points, we can always find something that is higher accurate. So we could have involved not just 3 points, but 5 points, and we would have obtained something like this, and this guy wouldn't be going like h squared, but it will be going to as h to the fourth. So in principle, there is no impediment in getting much higher accuracy if you are actually involving enough number of points. Okay, so now let us discuss how we would do this in particular, and I'm trying to get to a level where we can begin to think about the homework tomorrow even. So we're trying to solve that problem, as I said. These are our initial conditions. And let's say we're going to put boundary conditions that say that rather than solving in between minus infinity to infinity, let me just pick this particular interval, 0 to 1. And we're going to try to put the functions phi, say, to 0. That would be one option to put in boundary conditions. And then we'll see what the influence of that would be. Just as a recap, we're using this kind of representation for time levels like this, for a space like that. Our function, which there I wrote as u, now here is at I says phi. We just have a discrete number of levels and discrete number of points where we're representing with this finite number of values the continuous function, and by just looking at what the values of this function is at very specific values of time and at very specific points in space. And we are introducing this lambda, and which has actually a name, which is often called as either the Courant number or a Courant-Frederick-Levy number, which, as we'll see later on when we discuss stability of an implementation, that would be important. So this is pictorially what we're thinking. We have a grid that extends both in time and space. We have data of the solution configuration at some given instance of time. I want to know what happens to the future. We already discussed that we're going to use a single value h as our control parameter. So now let's see if we can come up with one option to discretizing our problem. So because we're thinking about of the second order equation, Oh, let me use five. So that's the problem we're trying to solve. We want to have now the discrete representation of this one, and we can use, remember, 3 points along the time direction to re-express the second derivative with respect to time, and 3 points along the space direction to represent the derivative, the spatial derivative. And we said that whenever we try to center, whenever, if possible, if we can center the unknown, or we can center our equation to have kind of equal balance in all possible directions, we'll probably be doing the most accurate. And again, as we go along, you'll see rigorously why this is the case. So given that I need 3 points for this one, 3 points for that one, a stencil I can use is the following. So I use 3 points. So imagine I center my equation there. I don't care at this moment what I know and what I don't know. I just want to center it. So I want to center my equation at that point. I'll use the point to the at n plus 1, that point, and n minus 1 to write the second time derivative. I do the same thing in space, to the left, to the right of that center point. And now I can rewrite our equation using this stencil that involves 5 points. And if I imagine that I have been evolving, or I'm marching forward to the future, at this point, I can imagine that I have everything at the level n, everything at the level n minus one, so the only unknown would be that point. So I can change out my system to actually say, oh, that's my unknown, let's solve for it. So what we would be doing is saying this is 5 at n plus 1 at the point j minus 2 phi and j plus phi and j minus 1 delta t square is equal to phi n j plus 1 minus 2 phi n j plus phi n j minus 1 divided by delta x square, but where I'm using the expressions for the second derivative that I left as an exercise. And so if the only unknown is, so if we know up to level n plus 1 everything, then the only thing that we don't know is this guy. So I can bring everything else to the right-hand side, or I can multiply by delta t squared first, and then I have an unknown that says, or a problem that says phi n plus 1 at the point j is equal to something that depends on phi n and phi n minus 1 in this case, and also, well, delta t over delta x, which is what we call lambda. So these are the steps that are defined here, which actually is written in a more verbose manner to actually indicate what is the approximation and how the errors are coming in. So this is the error that comes through the second time derivative. This is the error that comes through the second space derivative. And that's the approximation we just wrote. And we can use that coupled to the boundary equations, which the boundary conditions which we need. Notice that when we are taking the space derivative, given a point, I need to know the point to the left and the point to the right. But when I get to the boundary, I don't have a point to the left. If I get to the left boundary, when I get to the right boundary, I don't have a point to the right. So there is where we put our boundary conditions. So we can use this equation for all points j going from 2 to the last minus 1 point, and the boundary points are filled in or are defined by boundary conditions. So this is perhaps the simplest possible method to solve the second order wave equation, and it has its own name. It's called the leapfrog approximation. It's because you're jumping every other level to obtain the new level. And we'll see later on that this may not be the best method that you want to use, but it still is a reasonable method to get some solutions and get started in this kind of problems. So any questions at this point? I've gone kind of at a fast pace, but this is all very kind of intuitive, very direct. I was hoping that this wouldn't lead to problems, so you can check the notes. But if, as always, if you need any questions, you can always ask me or any of these guys that can answer any of the questions for sure. Let me just say a few more things, and then we'll stop for today. So as I said before, this is the expression that we mentioned. You can just use that approximation to say that I'm obtaining the value of phi n plus 1 in this way. But I want to make a few observations. The first is, where did we get it from? Okay, we got it from this approximation, which we know has an error. So each one has an error. So these we're gonna discuss in more detail later. But I just want to stress at this point a few obvious things. But this is something that is actually very crucial. That's the equation we wanted to solve. We change it. We're no longer solving that equation. We're solving this, which is an approximation to that one. So when we write this, we're solving an approximation to our original equation that has some error in it. So if you want, I can see it from here. So if I use this one, I can bring all this quote unquote crap that is left over to the left-hand side, same with this one, and I would be writing phi comma tt equal phi comma xx. We can then use these two, but I have some piece of error that I don't have control on. I'm only involving these 3 points in with respect to time levels and these three points with respect to space points, and there is this remnant error. So when we write this, and we say this is going to be the approximation that we use to obtain the value of the function phi at a time level n plus 1 times delta t, and at discrete points j, this is just an approximation to the problem we want to solve. If I compare this with the true solution, I would have some error left over here. And these instabilities and the accuracy of our system will depend on how these errors compound in time and how this solution will diverge from the true solution we're looking at. It's a problem that we really want to care to understand better, and this we'll discuss later on. But I just say a few more things before we wrap up. At least formally, at this kind of system that we derive here is saying phi at the level n plus 1 is equal to things that we know in a much more kind of general notation. What we say is that we can imagine we have a matrix, and we'll discuss in some particular case what this matrix might be. In this case, it's just the identity matrix, multiplying the unknown phi n plus 1, which is a vector that has n component, well, j components from the number 1 all the way to the n, equal to something that is known. And if we can invert this relation, if I can take the inverse of A multiply by the inverse of A to the left on sides on both sides of the equation, I will have phi n plus 1 equal to something that is completely known. So these are schemes, whenever you can write it in this form, or at least think that you write it in this form, the scheme is said to be explicit. Every time you're trying to obtain the value of the function at any given new level, you can do it in terms of things that you know. Other schemes are called implicit, where you actually have the unknown in the left and the right, in the left and right-hand sides, and then you have to think of it in a slightly different manner. And we'll discuss an example of it. So, no, I think at this point, this is a good point to stop. So, let me just stress, if you haven't, have you all tried? Well, no one probably has a problem yet. But the rest, have you tried to install the software? So well, you don't know if it works well for you, but if you just do XVS or DV, it probably pops out. The one thing I've done, let me just close this. I've added to the web page a new file. This is some of you might not be very familiar with Linux. I've added a file here, it's called account configuration file. So if you download that and you put it in, or if you click in here, let me just click in there, show you. So in your home directory, there is a file called .bashrc. You probably have no idea what that is, and I don't even have a good idea. Now, what it does is it has it's a way where the computer interfaces with your particular preferences, and it loads in memory every time you open a terminal configuration variables. And here I added a bunch of things. So just copy this piece, as it says in the instructions, to your bashrc. Make sure you don't erase anything that is already there. So just go to the end of that file and copy this piece from this dotted dashed line to the next one. And let me just give you, just say a few things of what it's doing if you don't know Unix. So for instance, this is saying that we're going to define a variable called capital CC, and that is going to, whenever the system sees that, it knows that what it has to do is just replace it by GCC. So that says this capital CCC will be, capital CCC, will be a stand-in for just the GNU compiler, the C GNU compiler. So if you have different codes and you that are compiled with, say, a C compiler, and you have more than one compiler in your system, you might want to try different compilers. And so by changing this, you can automatically change it in the rest of your computer. For the kind of things we will be using, so for instance, there are programs that, as you'll see, that we're going to use that make use of this RMPL that produces the code for you. So that's what we're saying is what that program is and where it's located. So for instance, in user local lib, that's where you have been installing your software. And it also tells the compiler what your path, and there's where to look for. Whenever you try to execute something, Ubuntu either looks locally or looks into some root directory where the rest of the things are. But if you have programs installed somewhere else, you have to tell them what they are. And you have installed all your software in this user local lib, include and lib, and bin. And so this is what this piece is doing. So just make sure you copy that in, and then you're going to be ready to go. So we're going to have, tomorrow we're going to pick up from where we are. We're going to discuss now better discretizations and some things that we want to know in order to, once you do your labs, you're going to be obtaining solutions. You want to be able to know what questions you have to ask to your numeric solution to convince yourself that you're getting the solution you set up to get, which is never clear. As I said, if you are doing a problem for the first time and you know the solution. And the point is, if you're wasting your time, quote unquote, trying to make an effort to compute a numerical solution, you're doing so because you cannot get it from any other means. Any other thing is easier. If you just can do it in pencil and paper, of course, that's what you should do. But in general, for most of the interesting problems that are there and that will come, you're going to be doing numerical simulations because you don't know what the answer is. And you're going to have to convince yourself and then everyone else that what you're getting is the right solution. And that's what we want to make sure we understand. OK, let's stop here.